This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Memoirs and Misinformation by Jim Carrey and Dana Vachon. Read for you by Jeff Daniels. For my big brother, John. For the name of a man is a numbing blow from which he never recovers. Marshall McLuhan. Prologue. They knew him as Jim Carrey, and by the middle of that December his lawn had burned to a dull amber brittle, and at night, after the sprinklers' 10 minutes of city-rationed watering, the grass blades floated in pooled water, limp and wasted like his mother's hair in the final morphine sweats. The city of Los Angeles had been moving hellward since April, with bone-dry reservoirs and strings of scorching days, the forecasts reading like a sadist's charm bracelet, 97, 98, 105, 103. Last week an F-16 had flashed like a switchblade through the ash-filled sky just as one of the gardeners on the Hummingbird Road estate collapsed of sunstroke and fell into seizures. The man fought as they carried him to the house, saying the Virgin Mary had promised him a slow dance for $3 in the cool shade of the ravine. At night came the Santa Anas, those devil winds that sapped the soul, that set police sirens wailing as the sunsets burned through napalm oranges into sooty mauves. Then each morning a smoggy breath would draw across the canyons and into the great house, passing through air filters recently equipped with sensors to detect assassination by nerve gas. He was bearded and bleary-eyed after months of breakdown and catastrophe. He lay naked in his bed, so far from peak form that if you watched through a hacked security camera at this moment, you might barely recognize him, might at first confuse him with a Lebanese hostage. Then, in a swell of facial recognition, you'd realize, this is no ordinary shut-in watching television alone on a gigantic bed. And as the blood-red Netflix logo glared from an unseen TV, you'd say, I know this man. I've seen him on everything from billboards to breakfast cereals. He's the movie star, Jim Carrey. Just weeks ago, 30 seconds of home security footage was leaked to the Hollywood Reporter by some traitor and his extended personal protection apparatus. In it, Carrey bobbed face down and fetal in his pool, wailing underwater like a captive orca. His publicist, Sissy Boche, told Variety that he was preparing to play John the Baptist for Terrence Malick, who conveniently declined comment. The video sold for $50,000, a sum just large enough to inspire that most sacred of animal behaviors, a spontaneous market response. After the fifth paparazzo scaled his backyard fence, his security team had it raised to 15 feet, electrified, and fringed with razor wire, an $85,000 job including the city council bribe. Jim had since begun to hear the sizzles and squeaks of electrocuted wildlife as a sorrowful necessity, animal sacrifice to his godhead. And while some believed Sissy Boche's John the Baptist story, most noted that it didn't explain Carrey's weight gain, or why some heard a distinctly Chinese accent in his moanings. It was now 2:58 in the morning. He'd been watching television for 7 hours. The binge had started with an episode of Ancient Predators featuring Megalodon, the super shark terror of the ancient seas. Then came Cro-Magnon versus Neanderthal, the story of how these early humans parted as cousins on the African plains, then remet as strangers in Europe, only to begin a contest of genocide. Cro-Magnon had slaughtered without mercy, leaving famished Neanderthal orphans staring out from French caves into a blizzard, whose screaming whiteness, Jim knew, was that of total erasure. He was half French-Canadian, and learned from the narrator that he carried Neanderthal DNA within him. He was descended from these orphans. Feeling their doom as his own, he'd begun crying tears of desolation, and then, unable to bear these, he'd hit pause with his grease-slicked thumb, freezing the screen on the tiny Neanderthal faces. For 10 minutes he lay trembling, muttering, "Oh, God," over and over, until Netflix, greedy for its own bandwidth, reset to the main menu, casting its red glow over him and his guard dogs. Identical twin, steel-tooth Rottweilers who both answered to Jophiel. Their name was shared for the sake of efficiency and emergency, so that if one of Jim Carrey's many enemies broke into the house and he had only seconds to act, he could summon both with a breath. Fearing this was the moment when he would discover his own long-standing non-existence, questioning even the value of an existence as part of a species forever looping between horror and heartache, he wondered if the latest viral news story vexing his publicists was right. Had he actually died while snowboarding in Zermatt? He'd seen a YouTube video about how time behaves strangely in death, your final seconds distending, yielding rich washes of experience. What if he had died in recent days, arriving not in a hell or a heaven, but rather a bed-bound purgatory? He'd heard stories about the Los Angeles morgue, bored attendants taking gross pictures of the famous fallen, selling them to TMZ for down payments on houses in the valley. He flipped to YouTube, whose algorithms, like reading his mind, offered a montage of celebrity death photos. A shot of John Lennon, face puddled on a gurney, splayed out for the crowd. If they could do this to John Lennon. His mind now conjured an image of his own lifeless form, swollen and foul. The morgue goons standing above him, cameras blazing. "Fuck," he breathed. Unsure if he'd breathed it or not. He'd gone to the bathroom, trying to reclaim existential certainty with a warm rush of urine through his middle-aged urethra. His heart was racing. What if it failed in his sleep and they found him in the morning, caked in his own excrement? What if the entire flight of paranoia that had brought him to this moment of feared death was a premonition of a future death, the Zermatt snowboarding disaster, just fate's deft misdirection? No. If death should come, he'd look his best. Crevice as clean as a whistle. Thus resolved, he'd sat on his Japanese toilet and evacuated his bowels, wiped himself, and hopped in the shower, thoroughly sponging the orifice, then drying and powdering himself. He moved to the vanity mirror and kept going, trimming his wiry eyebrows, plucking the wolf hairs from his ears, rubbing bronzer across his forehead, his neck, around his clavicles in a broad swoop, so he looked like a Grecian bust. Now he was ready for the boys at the morgue. Here was a great star, they'd say, a box office god of the kind they don't make anymore. Now he was marginally less afraid. He settled back into bed and began watching the first thing Netflix offered, Pompeii Reconstructed, Countdown to Disaster. This was the Hamptons, a Riviera of the ancient world, said the host, Ted Berman, an off-brand Indiana Jones in a thrift store fedora. Once again, Jim felt reality blurring into fiction as a digitally animated cloud of burning ash billowed up from Mount Vesuvius. The computerized notion of a camera's POV rose with it, high above the city, then stopped and panned into the volcanic crater, which suddenly seemed so very endless and all-devouring that Carrie cried out, "Security inventory!" "Internal zones clear," replied his house, in the voice of a Singaporean opium heiress who summered in Provence. "You are safe, Jim Carrey." "Defense barrier status?" "Fully electrified." "Let's do a voltage surge, just to be sure." The television's light dimmed as he heard a sound like a giant zipper being pulled around the property, 20,000 volts of electricity surging through his razor wire fence. "Tell me I'm safe again," said Carrie, and loved. "You are safe," and loved. "Tell me something nice about me." "Your monthly water usage is down 3%. Flatterer. The television regained brightness. The program resumed. An earthquake had just rocked Pompeii, a natural phenomenon that the Romans had never experienced. Some thought it was the first act of a miracle and stayed to see more. Others were less sure, fleeing through the city gates. "No one could have guessed," said Ted Berman, "that all who remained would die." A succession of desperate moments with the documentary's main characters, a shipping magnate and his pregnant wife, young sisters born into a brothel, a high-ranking magistrate, his family, and their African slave. Eyes tearing, Jim wondered, was it wise to keep watching Pompeii? With the images of megalodons still fresh on the brain, with those Neanderthal orphans still paused in their French cave? Charlie Kaufman once told him that cinema's guiding illusion of distinct frames affecting fluid continuity was the same trick that creates the impression of time in the mind. That past and present are invented concepts, necessary fictions. Were he and the Pompeians just disparate squares of celluloid? Were they feeling the collapse of his world just as he was feeling the destruction of theirs? Was there only one pain? If this was true, then it must hold not only for the original Pompeians, but for the actors playing them, people struggling for the next job, to be seen, to matter. Money was in charge now. Money had made them all indentured dreamers. "I don't have to be like this. I could leave right now and just be happy." But what would happy look like? At that moment, he couldn't remember. An awful grief pulled him deep into the bed, multiplying his every pound 1,000-fold. He summoned the strength to lift his thumbs and text Nicolas Cage, a man whose artistic bravery had always given him courage. "Nick, when you said the spirits of the dead are all around us, did you mean that poetically or truly?" But his exquisite friend did not answer. "Nick?" Again. Again. No reply. Seconds fell like loads of granite on top of him. He considered abandoning Netflix. He would eat the tuna niçoise in his refrigerator, then go outside and maybe play drown in the pool. He raised his head off the pillow, ready for action, but then stopped, suddenly sure that he owed Pompeii's dead a full and unbroken viewing. He pressed play. Sets of unearthed remains were being digitally reconstructed by archaeologists from Frankfurt. Where, Jim Carrey wondered, would this technology be when he was dug up? What would people of the future conclude about him? Could they ever guess at what had writhed within his skull? His flayed father? His sweet suffering mom? Might they one day reconstruct the ruins of the mind as well as those of the body? The skeletons of the two sisters found in the Pompeii brothel had malformed teeth, the effects, the researchers concluded, of congenital syphilis. They were born with this social disease through no fault of their own, said Ted Berman. Totally innocent and yet in constant pain. The girls now received their close-up in a dramatized flashback, latexed pustules bubbling off their eyelids as they gazed up toward Mount Vesuvius. In 1993, the guru Viswanathan had observed Carrie's aura as a glorious, radiant rose gold, and taught him to sense its shiftings within his transient form. Now he felt it arcing out toward the television as the syphilis twins cowered beneath the volcanic rain. He feared his soul was being taken from him, or worse, that it was fleeing. Jophiel, affection, he tried to say, but could only gasp as, on the TV, Vesuvius's ash cloud blotted out the sun, plunged into darkness with a new appreciation for the word's impossibility. Carrie finally managed to bark, affection, and immediately the two Rottweilers clambered up to lie on either side of him, licking the tears from his beard. Deep affection, cried Carrie, and the dogs, who had been trained to treat whoever spoke those words as a nursing mother and regard themselves as exactly 6 weeks old, moved from merely licking his face to nuzzling his neck, their muscles so warm that Carrie might have confused the Pavlovian error for true nurture, were it not for their steel teeth grazing the outline of his jugular. He looked back to the TV, a shot of human bones on a steel table. Female remains, one of the Germans said. The camera zoomed in on a blue laser matrix, completing the scan. A wealthy woman, perhaps 18 years old. The program cut to a flashback. The woman in her villa, dining on a silk couch, a delicate beauty wiping her husband's mouth with a kindness that Jim knew was drawn from the actress's own way of loving. The only truly selfless love he'd ever known, a giving without thought of taking, was with Linda Ronstadt in the rainy July of 1982. 16 years older, she'd sing him a Mexican love song, Volver, Volver, a yearning lullaby that would settle through him as she held him to her sun-brown chest, running her fingers through his hair. Volver, Volver, Volver. The words traveling forward through time to this moment. Come back, come back, come back. But how could he? He was not the bright-eyed boy she'd held. Had he killed that innocent kid, then dissolved the body in the acids of debauchery? He envied the doomed Pompeian man and his tender wife. He felt terribly alone there on the bed, Linda's voice whispering through him. Volver, Volver, Volver. As the laser matrix danced down the woman's skeleton, pausing over a set of bones scattered about beneath her ribcage, one of the Germans typed commands into his computer. On its screen, renderings of the bones gathered in a digital womb to form a tiny skeleton. A few more keystrokes gave it a shadeless layer of pink skin, a pair of tadpole eyes, a half-formed hand, a tiny finger plugged into a cupped mouth. She is with child, said the German, boy child. And now new tears of abandoned hope joined Carrie's earlier tears of desolation. The cloud of superheated ash is collapsing under its own weight, explained Ted Berman. And while the woman and her husband were safe from falling pumice in their vaulted villa, they will now suffer Pompeii's worst fate, thermal shock. As the air temperature reaches 500 degrees, the woman's soft tissues will literally explode, her brain shattering her skull. No, said Jim Carrey. The baby's skull also explodes, perhaps a fraction of the second after the explosion of the mother's intestines through her ribcage. Please don't, he begged. And then, across his billion-pixel screen, the volcanic plume collapsed beneath its own mass, cascading down the sides of the digital Vesuvius. The syphilis girls, the magistrate, the young lovers and their child, all of them and their dreams, carbonized. Flash assumed into the death cloud whose blackness darkened the Hummingbird Road bedroom as it rolled across the digital Bay of Naples. Carey moaned sorrow, closed his eyes like a little boy. When he opened them again, Ted Berman was walking Pompeii's excavated streets in the present day. The camera panned across rows of plaster casts, bodies arrested in death, some with faces of abject terror, some guarding piled treasure with weapons, others tranquil, resigned. And finally, a husband and wife lying together, his hand on her pregnant stomach. And Jim Carrey, known for wild pratfalls and joyous mayhem, he curled into a ball and started weeping. Yes, he was a real mess. But once he'd shone so brilliantly, oh, you should have seen him. Chapter 1. A world before, he'd starred in a major summer spectacle, a movie that had effortlessly cruised to a $220 million global box office, with 35% of this fortune marked for Carey personally, flooding into his financial reservoirs from distribution territories stretching, as was said, from Tuscaloosa to Timbuktu. That the film was, even by his own estimation, firmly in his second tier, only made its success sweeter. The greater the impunity, the closer to God. He'd filled with the love of the crowd as the blockbuster rolled out and on, opening in London, Moscow, Berlin. He entered Rome as a slapstick Caesar, walking a 100-yard-long red carpet where he saw a publicist crouching right in his path and, gauging the moment like a cliff diver, the rising tide, tripped right over the guy, going down spread eagle, head and shoulders, walloping the carpet so hard that the crowd believed he'd died right in front of them. Lying there, Carey thought of his Uncle Des, shot and killed in a Bigfoot costume while on his way to prank a corn boil. Some lunged to help the star. Others just gasped. Carey let their concern build before bouncing up like a coil and giving every subsequent interview with one eye crossed. After, there was a dinner in his honor at the Quirinale Palace. A table for 100 had been set by the President of the Italian Republic. They'd all come for a brush with performative genius and watched appreciatively as, at the head of the table, Carey asked the veteran sommelier pouring wine into his glass if he could inspect the bottle. The man stopped and handed it to him. Jim sniffed the cork and examined the label. All of it just a setup for the moment where he plugged the bottle into his mouth and took a long chug before, with the face of a true connoisseur, declaring, "Wonderful. They'll love it." They did. They roared, all of them. The Swiss art dealer and the three men from Merck and the waiters watching from the kitchen where the cooks were laughing too. And the Camorra enforcer who had that week put two bodies in the Tiber. And the Swedish ambassador's husband. They laughed for this sudden relief from the burden of manners. And the laughter bound them across languages as they ate and drank on the marble terrace in the Roman night. A 12-piece orchestra played tangos, music that moved the owner of a dry cleaning chain, a round woman, lonely in her late 50s, to decide after three Proseccos that, having paid $5,000 to a corrupt senator's even more corrupt secretary to be here, there was no reason not to approach Carey for a dance. She moved toward him like a heat-seeking credenza, and something in the boldness of her spirit swayed Jim Carey. He waved away his bodyguards and took her hand, leading her out onto the colonnade. They tangoed passionately. She was surprisingly nimble, ready for every turn, even though her fingers, greasy from the grilled branzino, kept slipping from his. He turned it into a set piece, feigning lover's frustration, before taking her arm and throwing it over his shoulder, then pulling her close with eyes that said, "I'll never lose you again." It had been so long since she was held. They spun like galaxies colliding, the whole orchestra soaring, the grifting crowd demanding crescendo and receiving it, as Carey dipped the woman in his arms and, seeing her lips pucker in invitation to kiss, licked her sweaty face from the chin up to the forehead, then stared at her like a happy puppy. This brought the whole room to its feet, love's caricature sowing want of its real form in the hearts of all present, even his own. Soon he was back home in Brentwood. Not a flicker of joyful mayhem in that famous face, only languor, where so much raw charisma had recently shown. The movie was falling from popular consciousness. He felt his spirits fading with it, as if by unknown laws of human industrial entanglement. He was lonely, and he was longing, truly, if ridiculously, for the real version of that which he'd clown-played with the dry-cleaning Duchessa. She'd given him a voucher for 10 free shirt pressings, and taking it from his wallet, he'd fixate, masochistically, on all that might have been with Renee Zellweger, his last great love. She'd left him for a bullfighter, Morante de la Puebla. His heart had never completely healed, he realized, alone now on his Brentwood couch, numbing himself in television. He was clicking back and forth between engineering the Reich, where Wernher von Braun was shooting men through the sound barrier as practice for the Apollo program, and Vietnam reunions in HD, where a legless American hugged a toothless Vietnamese on the jungle hillock where each had lost his youth. It was in the switching space between programs that Carey glimpsed TNT's Oksana, and one of his mind's trillion synapses fired brighter than all the others, demanding that he stay on the channel. There he saw a C or even D-list actress, Georgie Debusschere, as fully into the character of a Russian assassin as her modest talents allowed, torturing the Kyrgyzstani arms dealer whom she'd lured to a Bucharest safe house with promises of exotic sex. She drugged and bound him, then, when he woke, demanded the antidote to a flesh-eating virus currently thwarting her character's plot arc, citing the virus's rapid mutation rate. The man said he couldn't help her. She buried her power drill into his femur, then killed him with a judo chop to the nose. Beholding Georgie in this moment of high violence, Jim's subconscious saw her eyes as his mother's eyes, her skin as his mother's skin, and her nose as his mother's nose, an error that filled his conscious mind with raw, candied rapture. His early life was marked by the financial struggles of a beloved father, Percy, whose smile grew apace with the family's descent into poverty. His mother, Kathleen, sometimes channeled their decline viscerally, as her own imagined dying. "The doctors say my brain is deteriorating at an incredible rate," she would tell the family at the dinner table, her words filling young Jim with terror, fear that one day he'd return from school to find his mother lying brainless on the floor. Doctors prescribed codeine and Nembutal. She grew dependent on the painkillers, as so many have. He performed his earliest comic routines trying to make her feel better, a rail-thin 7-year-old entering her bedroom in his BVDs, pretending he was an attacking praying mantis, head crooked, pincers flailing, making her laugh against her suffering, which grew over time. But the painkillers, over decades, took their toll. She'd lie there, rigid with arthritis, chain-smoking on the sofa of the North Hollywood apartment where Carey had invited his mother and father to live with him, when they ran out of money in old age. He'd come home from work on his first television series, NBC's The Duck Factory, to find her fast asleep on the sofa, stray cigarettes smoldering into the cushions. Then the show was canceled and running out of cash. He told them with deepest regret that they needed to go back to Canada, where at least if they got sick, they could afford health care. He promised to send them money. "You never see anything through, Jim," she told him. "You just never see anything through." It was a crushing blow. Sometimes he'd dream of strangling her, then wake in cold sweats, guilty for his own imagined matricide, filled with a want of lost nurture that came back to him now, watching Georgie on TV. Who was this actress whose image stirred him so? What was this show? He pressed info. Oksana. Subjects of an aborted Cold War experiment finally seek their truth. Across 20 mind-rotting hours, he joined them. He watched Georgie Debussier and her sisters battle to the Moscow laboratory, where they learned that they were all programmed killers, all hatched from the eggs of Soviet gymnasts, fertilized with the frozen sperm of one Iosif Vissarionovich Djugashvili, better known as Joseph Stalin, raised by supercomputers on an unmapped Aleutian island. Awed by her beauty, he imagined her as a minor Kennedy, the only girl in a family of brothers. They must have played touch football on the beach after clam bakes, he thought, watching her lay out a henchman with a roundhouse kick. He couldn't have been more wrong. She'd been born 70 miles outside of Iowa City, raised on a street of broken sidewalks. Her father was an alcoholic gym teacher. Her mother was a quiet and accommodating labor room nurse. Georgie was one of eight children who fought viciously over bathroom time and frozen dinners. By her 14th birthday, she had risen from the middle to the top of the pecking order, dominating her seven siblings, Kathy, Bobby, Cliff, Gretchen, Vince, Buster, and Denise. The family's increasingly strained resources, making each child just a touch craftier than the one before. She'd won a Rotary scholarship to Michigan State, where, assigned by a mainframe error to a graduate-level game theory seminar, decision-making for changing times, she earned an A without even trying, finding the concepts came naturally. After graduation, she went to Los Angeles, working briefly in print modeling, before submitting an essay on Robinson Crusoe and a set of bikini pictures to the casting agent who landed her a contestant spot on Survivor Lubang. There, across the summer of 2000, she became loathed by millions for betraying her best friend in the Jilau tribe, a Mary Kay sales representative named Nancy Danny Dibble. Dole featured an acne scarred. Nancy had been cast for the strong response she elicited in focus groups, pure pity. The producers had planted her as a moral obstacle. For the contestants, the logical move was to dispatch her quickly, without regret. But what of the debt owed the weak by the strong? What of the viewers' delusions of morality and the wrath that lived just beneath them? Thinking to gain an ally on the cheap, Georgie shared her lip balm with Nancy during their first hours on the island as the castaways were ordered through 17 takes of wading ashore. And while Nancy Danny Dibble may have never known a lover, she was a creature as erotic as any other. It's all there online, 5 seconds long, a voyeur's opera, compacted longing rushes through Nancy's eyes as Georgie applies the chapstick to her lips. How long has it been since Nancy Danny Dibble was touched? I need more, she says, and Sir Georgie runs the balm over her lips again. The gesture far exceeded whatever modest aims Georgie had for it, seeding a friendship that was cemented in episode 3, when, face lit by campfire, Georgie observed to Nancy that Danny was an odd middle name for a woman. The cameraman crouched low, his lens only feet from Nancy's face. As she told how she'd taken it to honor the brother who drowned in the rainy spring of 1977, diving into a swollen Mississippi creek to rescue Dolly, a mass of dish rags and mop bits with purple button eyes, the only doll that Nancy had ever owned. Even in America, even from a casting pool of 80,000, this was no ordinary misery. Nancy's sorry aria soared until, with a feeble sob, she reached into the night like it might contain a wisp of Danny's hair. Georgie comforted Nancy, running her fingers through her hair, its Walgreens dye already fading in the sun. "Georgie," said Nancy, "I'd have liked if we were sisters." "Nancy," said Georgie, as if the cameras weren't there, "we are sisters." They pledged to win and split the money. But Nancy's misery proved contagious, handicapped by this woman, who also had arthritic knees, her very gait a show of weakness. The Gilao lost a string of elimination challenges. Soon they were half the strength of the La Yang, teetering on the edge of game show extinction. Ratings soared. Georgie DeBuscher's bikinied body became known to bankers and janitors, all in condos and projects. And why not? $1 million was up for grabs here. Enough money to grant that wildest of American wishes, escape from the lower class. Nancy Danny Dibble still believed Georgie would deliver them a victory. At night, she dreamed herself driving a new, fully loaded Chevy Malibu through Jackson, Mississippi's finer suburbs, received by glowing housewives as a valued friend. Georgie, however, knew the game was lost, and soon wanted just a warm bath. One night, she walked up the beach, then crawled through the undergrowth to lie in a stream where, bracing herself into the silt, she felt the edge of a dagger dropped by a Japanese corporal 3 days before Hiroshima. She worked the blade loose from the riverbed, tucked it into her shorts. The next morning, clenching it in her teeth, she swam deep into the cove, past the turquoise shallows, into darker depths where she encountered a full-grown moray eel. How many watched Christ on the Mount? 10 million, ogled Georgie as she rose from the surf. The poor eel, the only innocent in this whole equation, slung around her neck, dripping black-green guts into her cleavage. She'd hunt again and trade her kill for a favor after the next tribal merger. One of the Gilao was sure to go, and while the Liang were likely intent on eliminating the strongest, Georgie bribed them toward the weakest, Nancy Danny Dibble. "Nancy's made us weak," she'd whispered. "She'll destroy you too." "I thought we were sisters." Nancy wept at the elimination ceremony when the votes were finally read. "You promised. Say something." And here, as elsewhere, Georgie paid less for raw cunning than brutal honesty. The statement which viewers found so reprehensible was only made so for its cold truth, its unflinching appraisal of the crude gears that animate illusions of freedom. Georgie believed she'd done nothing wrong. She forgot the cameras and drew from the game theory she'd learned at Michigan State. All of life is a series of interlocking games, mainly meaningless, perhaps rigged, she told Nancy. "Some have rules we know. Most have rules we do not. Are we being guided to some higher state? Or just forced from game board to game board for no end at all? The only way to know is to do what the games demand." "I did only what the game demanded." Nancy's cheeks glistened with tears. The torches coughed up sparks. And the Liang, sensing themselves in the presence of an advanced player, decided Georgie would be the next to go. She quickly returned to Los Angeles, bent on turning infamy into celebrity. Represented by Ventura Talent Associates, she spent 3 years trying to become an actress, billed as the eel slayer of Lubang, taking meetings for talk shows that never happened, winning roles in stillborn network pilots, unable to shake her survivor anti-fame until, the greater horror, it was all gone. She posed for men's magazines, each time wearing less, each time earning less. A gig as an auto show bikini girl led to a job selling cars at Mazda of Calabasas, where court documents allege she once stole a used Miata. In time, she married Darren Lucky Dealey, a rage-prone stuntman fired from leaping walls of fire for Rutger Hauer after assaulting a sound technician. Shortly before their first wedding anniversary, he gave her a black eye, and she, in turn, sprinkled rat poison in his protein powder. Here was romance tragic even for a fading reality star. It was 7 years, the biblical length of plagues, before fate showed her any favor, and even then, it was cruel. Mitchell Silvers was a television writer and producer who, as a USC undergraduate, had obsessed over Georgie on Survivor. As an adult, he abused power in service of desire, arranging through her VTA agent to meet Georgie at the Chateau Marmont. There, with a medicated lack of effect that she mistook for innocence, he offered to cast her on his upcoming TNT espionage series in exchange for sex in a junior suite. "It's just sex," she told herself, "a means to an end. Molecules bouncing around." 2 months later, responding to Silver's threats to abandon the project, TNT cast Georgie as the Russian assassin Nadia Permanova, a hard-bodied killer fighting Central Asian warlords in the form-fitting dominatrix gear that so beguiled Jim Carrey, who as a young boy had fetishized the buxom Vampirella. And who, as a man, watched slack-jawed as Stalin's daughters entered the Moscow lab, where they found primitive hard drives containing every memory to be wiped from their brains across such lethal girlhoods, lost selves locked in magnetic tape. And finally, in a secret chamber, specimen jars containing human embryos floating in murky formaldehyde, the waste products of their creation. Georgie's character flew into a rage, smashing everything in sight. And as the prop fetuses bounced across the concrete floor, Jim Carrey felt all the pain of lost love vanish. He felt himself, suddenly and surely, receiving nothing less wondrous than a message from the cosmos. Georgie, he knew, was his soulmate. Chapter 2. Call it messy, call it madness. Carrey called it love. He contacted Georgie through his publicist and suggested they share a night of self-discovery under the guidance of Natchez Gushu, a guru then popular among the city's spiritual seekers. Across the 90s, Gushu had turned a Tucson auto zone into a real estate empire. At his peak, swaggering around the city in a Stetson and fringed jacket, boasting of his royal Cherokee blood, asserting a spiritual mandate to reclaim his ancestors' land with a sprawl of Pollo Locos and payday lenders. Lawsuits describe him as delusional, profligate, only barely Cherokee. They say his empire was ruined by the same psychosis that found him at the end, driving around Tucson with a loaded Uzi on his lap, ranting in word salad, high on methamphetamine. Natchez said that he embraced poverty willingly after receiving visions of Jim Morrison in a Cherokee ghost dance, that if only more spiritually attuned, the Tucson police might not have mistaken his mystic tongues for word salad. He posted bail with cash he'd hidden in a fiberglass lawn armadillo, then fled north to California, prospecting for souls. His first job was with Deepak Chopra, leading quantum encounter workshops for corporate executives. But Natchez soon found fault with Chopra's teachings, perhaps because there was fault to be found, perhaps because he himself needed to be the alpha guru. He rejected Deepak's view of an eternal spirit as incompatible with the destructive nature of the universe. How, he asked, could Chopra deliver people from suffering through fantasy? No. It worked the other way around. The truth of cosmic brutality would unveil the truths of the self. Soon he was using meditation not to gloss over traumas, but to induce them. One day he slipped ayahuasca to a group of Avis executives, then led them all in a visualization of the firebombing of Dresden that left four vice presidents curled fetal behind the healing pagoda. Natchez was demoted to office work. A yurt that housed the sacred gourd went up in flames. Then Chopra cast Natchez out of his realm, a move that might have ended his career if he hadn't already found his first devoted follower in Kelsey Grammer. Grammer, who in 2006 joined Gushu in meditations upon the Malibu mudslides where Natchez had helped Kelsey retrieve memories of his mother, holding him in the moments just after his birth. Kelsey had seen every blue grain of her eyes, and in retrieving this image said he felt, however fleetingly, unconditional love. So was born another gospel in a country already frothing them from its mouth, Gushuism, a word at which critics often would exclaim, Gesundheit, was a hodgepodge of extreme sports and regression therapy, leading adherents not away from the brutality of man and nature, but rather headlong into both. What his following lacked in numbers, it made up for in status. Grammer had, over the years, seen to that. Small, illustrious groups often gathered on the ocean-facing patio of the Carbon Beach guesthouse, where Natchez spent his days contemplating, he sometimes bragged, the jagged edge of America's dream. Jim and Georgie joined them as a Pacific hurricane hit Malibu, a storm that had killed hundreds south in Mexico, then, tired but still hungry, turned up the California coast. He found her even more alluring in person. He knew that past life memories were sometimes recovered here, and wondered if the same forces that were uniting him and Georgie now had done so before. Had they loved in other lives? Would they retrieve visions of those encounters? That would be something. He pictured them in timeless lovemaking, eons speeding harmlessly by as they burned through the positions of the Kama Sutra. And in this he grew so aroused that he failed to notice the half-stunned interest with which Georgie studied the other guests, his peers. So this was it, she thought, standing among the A-listers on the patio. They all worked together, worshipped together. They shared agents and lawyers and gurus. It was a regular fame cartel, a rigged game, at least until someone brought you in. Are you excited? Carrie asked her. Sure, said Georgie. Then, noticing Gwyneth Paltrow in a pair of $1,000 heels across the way, removed her own scuffed pumps and placed them in her bag, taking the role of barefoot hippie girl as her strongest available option. Paltrow was in pain. She had spent the past week yachting off Cannes with Brian Grazer, hosted by moneyed Moroccans, speaking in hushed tones, trading wheat for oil, oil for assault rifles for artillery shells. They wanted film investments to launder dirty cash. She'd hated how this thrilled her. Feel nature's might, her majesty. Natchez sat with legs folded on a wicker sedan, belly bulging beneath a linen tunic three sizes too small. We are breathing. We draw deep breaths. We are Orpheus entering Hades, boomed Kelsey Grammer, explorers of the great within. And we remain quiet until the spirit moves us, said Natchez. We are assiduously refraining from narration, from observation, from crosstalk. Indeed, we are quiet, said Kelsey in a stage whisper. We hushed, we blessed few. Natchez could read his disciples' faces and, in the quivering of Gwyneth Paltrow's lips, sensed an inner journey had begun even before she spoke. The Spence School, Manhattan, senior year. It's early May, and I really feel the spring coming on. A third-floor biology class, after school, dust grains dancing amid columns of vernal light. utterly sublime, said Kelsey Grammer. Crosstalk, snapped Natchez, then calmly, Gwyneth, continue. We all got frogs to dissect. I was reticent at first, but when the knife hit the flesh, it's like I lost all fear. The blade seemed to guide me, so precise, so efficient. I finished the frog in a single class. So then the teacher, Mr. Libertucci, he gave me a cat. I finished that in 2 days. It was like some greater force was driving me to see how it all connected, to find out what makes it meow. So then he gave me a fetal pig. Paltrow's brow furrowed as her inner eye surveyed the past. I'm seeing it now. Yes, said Natchez. Dare forward. I'm seeing the tiny pig in the wax bottom dissection tray. Her face fell as she continued, eyes shut, almost like a sleeping child. And something's coming up from within me. I fight it. I have to fight it. Don't fight it, said Kelsey Grammer. Be as the lotus. God damn it, Kelsey, snapped Natchez. It's an awareness that I'm not here for learning. I'm here, all alone, after school. I'm here for the joy of pulling a blade through flesh, said Paltrow. Whoa, girl, said Goldie Hawn. I've been looking forward to this all day. She let out a deranged giggle. The pig is an intelligent animal, a closer relative, a greater thrill than to dismember. Oh, dear, I probably shouldn't be sharing this. You must, said Natchez. Dare forward. I pull my scalpel down the abdomen, Gwyneth said. I tear the fascia away. I'm in total control. I hack through the ribcage, its voided eyes looking at me. Its gaze, said Natchez softly. How does it affect you? I feel guilty, maybe. Also lucky. A sudden light came across her face. It's death's gaze. Death's gaze? I want death to know I'm not afraid, blurted Kelsey Grammer, tears of sudden realization rolling down his cheeks. Kelsey, boomed Natchez, stop hijacking other people's epiphanies. Gwyneth, what happens next? I cut its fucking head off, exploded Gwyneth. Okay, I'll tell Mr. Libertucci I did it to examine the vertebrae, but that's a lie. I did it because I could. It's not enough to feel death's gaze. I want to do death's work, to deal death. Lordy, said Goldie Hawn. I stare into its fucking gaping pig eyes as I cut through its spine, and I'm sad with each motion to know I'm closer to the end, because we're studying botany next. Guru? Yes? Is there such a thing as evil? No, my dear, said Natchez. Not on this porch. Carrie squeezed Georgie's hand as if to say, have you ever seen magic like this? She gave no response. She, too, had traveled back. Suddenly, she was 6 years old again, her face pressed against the incubation chamber of the only sibling she'd ever felt close to, Denise, born 2 months premature. A fragile chest beat red, begging small breaths from the world. Denise now worked at a jewelry kiosk in a mall outside Iowa City, subsisting on minimum wage. A sadness for the smallness of her sister's life filled Georgie as Sean Penn lit an unfiltered Camel from the burgundy velour Lazy Boy that was his recognized seat. The smell of cheap tobacco took Carrie back to the Titan Wheels factory, to working with his father and brother, all their money pooled for heat, gas, and food. He was 16, still a boy, and yet with a full-grown rage inside of him, an urge, so very natural, to destroy the factory that took them as no different and less precious than the piles of steel truck rims marked for buffing and blasting. He remembered slamming a pallet truck into the conveyor belts again and again and again. Below him, the waves crashed. And yet he declined to share this memory. He held Georgie's hand as the trauma gripped him, a panicked child. And her touch drained his pains away. For him, it was further proof of her chosenness. For her, it was the start of a long journey into his hauntings. "Animal-faced Pez dispensers," said Sofia Coppola, "lined up on a Sonoma windowsill. Purple plastic testing containers warm with diabetic urine," said Goldie Hawn, "sitting on the kitchen counter of my blind Uncle Warren. Strawberry-flavored codeine," said Sissy Spacek. It had been 6 months since Sean Penn had shared any memory, and that had been only two words. Bloodstained doilies. All came to attention as he spoke from the burgundy Lazy Boy, never once turning from the storm. A bald child in a Ritz-Carlton swimming pool. It doesn't matter where. This kid's already outside space and time. His skin's almost translucent. He's 6 or 7. Head still big on the body. That amplifies the skull cavities. Strains the muscles of his little neck and shoulders. He coughed. Something bulging from inside this little kid's chest, jutting at odd angles against the skin. Fearless. Natchez regarded Penn as more peer than pupil. And it's a chemoport. Bandages, surgical tape. What are they trying to do? Buy him a few more months, weeks, or maybe just a morning in a Ritz-Carlton swimming pool. 500 bones a night, peak season. People trading coward glances as slowly they all get out of the water like he's some turd. Contagion. They ain't taking any chances. In 10 minutes, he's all alone there, turning weak circles, skimming his hands across the water's skin. "Did you fear the death in him?" Natchez whispered. "Ah," said Penn with a rasp. "I feared the death in them. Marvelous." "I could use a glass of water," said Nick Cage. "I'm getting very thirsty." "Follow that thirst," said Kelsey Grammer. "Dare forward, Cage." "Next time you will leave the porch," said Natchez. "We have discussed the importance of respect and non-interference, yet you do not learn." And Grammer, chastised, quieted as Cage shared what would be the strangest memory of the night. "I see the city of Los Angeles," he began, "all in flames, burning. I see flying saucers hovering above the canyons. And what the fuck is this?" said Goldie Hawn. "I'm saying what I see. Please respect my flow." "Continue, Nick," said Natchez, "please." "I see these aliens with exoskeletons, like iron spiders, shooting death beams everywhere. A bowel-twisting firepower. Oh, man, all these demon-red death beams. Sky covered in smoke. The end-time sun. It's red like a, for a moment they hoped the memory would trail off, but then it came to them, like a baboon's ass." "This is a memory?" said James Spader. "When you put the bucket down the well and you bring it back up, you don't always get water," said Cage. "Sometimes you get a wolverine that's been trapped down there forever and he claws out your eyes. So yeah, I'm seeing a big baboon-ass sun. I'm charging down the Pacific Coast Highway. Fire is burning in the canyons, buildings reduced to smoldering rubble. I lead a band of last survivors, and we—" "He's grandstanding," said Kelsey Grammer. "Sheer narcissism." "Continue, Nick," Natchez said. "Kelsey, hush. We fight these aliens. Come to kill us. Giant, snaky guys. Skin all slick and glistening black. I lead the last survivors against these extraterrestrials who have come to annihilate humanity. Armageddon. They shoot us with these death beams, but the death beams, they don't affect me, because my DNA is not like other DNA. Coppola genes are different. That's why I felt so out of place my whole life. It's the burden I bear to save everyone. And this is a plagiarism of War of the Worlds, said Kelsey. Mule fucked with the Christ myth is what this is. He enters groups and he cannot help but sabotage for the sake of his own need to feel special. He did it in Goldblum's drama class. Don't you Goldblum me. You made a farce of that workshop. It was a nouveau shamanic experiment, a venture to the freedom that lies beyond the edge of annoyance. Hush, both of you, said Natchez. Time runs in all directions. So, then, must memory. No temporal judgments here, please. Nick, continue. Now Cage rolled his eyes back so only the whites showed, and no one could tell if he was being serious or not, as, in a voice deeper than his natural speaking tone, he said, the death beams, they bounce off me, like peas. Everyone else? Not so lucky. Flesh bubbling off their bodies. Death beams zinging and zooshing all around. This flesh-rendering heat, I can feel it down in my bones, can feel the marrow simmering. He clawed at his arms. Now a big alien's coming at me. He's hideous. Oh God, he's so horrific. I can't even... You must, said Natchez. He's got red eyes, a fat red stripe down his snaky body. He's got fangs. He's bearing down on me, bent to kill, there beneath the baboon-ass sun. I'm so afraid of my destiny, which is to fight this guy. Oh God, I'm so afraid. Snakes beneath the baboon-ass sun, said Kelsey Grammer, incredulous. And Natchez might have banished Grammer to sit inside by the water cooler were he not so attuned to the battle raging within the man who, of all possible names, had chosen to call himself Cage. Don't recoil, Nick. Dare forward. Okay, I'm going forward. Now it's even clearer. I have a sword of ancient steel, a relic of the Crusades. I left that out so far because it wasn't relevant. And I know in my gut it's the only thing that can kill an alpha alien, which is my destiny. I close on him, lunging with my sword, but he dodges me, rears up, spits this black, snotty stuff in my eyes. Oh God, I can't see. It smells so horrible, the alien snot. Ah! Get him off me! Fight it, Nick, said Kelsey Grammer as Cage began to gag. He's coiling around me, constricting me like a boa. Cage tearing at his neck, trembling. I'm losing my grip on my sword. I'm feeling my arms go limp. I'm looking into the alpha's red serpent eye, and I'm feeling... What do you feel, said Natchez? What comes over you? Afraid. Cage's lip curled, eyes trickling old tears. God, I'm so afraid. There, there, said Kelsey, suddenly pitying, laying a hand on Cage's shoulder with such kindness that Natchez forgave all his earlier trespasses. How very kind of you, Kelsey, he said. How deeply empathic. Baby's gonna go, said James Spader, pointing to a little shed on the beach below, nearly submerged in the surf. As they rose to watch, Carrie and Georgie held each other's eyes for a second of deep appraisal. There was an excess of eagerness about him that she chose not to question. He emoted what he felt to be the golden light of love. She gave him her hand. Then they joined the rest, watching the structure torn from its foundation, smashed by the ocean, yielding inflatable alligators and flamingos to dance on the dark waves. Storms are getting stronger. Water's rising. The earth is growing angry, said Natchez. Soon there will be nothing here but fire, water, and mud. Thank God I found you, thought Carrie, staring rapt at Georgie's silhouette. Chapter 3. Now two lives entwined. The boy who'd fled Toronto's factories and the girl still fleeing Iowa's cornfields agreed that the night being young, they should go to Carrie's beach house. They took his Porsche down the Pacific Coast Highway, satellite radio playing the seventh movement of Fauré's Requiem, In Paradisum. While no classical aficionado, Carey was moved by the music, sensing the majesty of the chorale as inseparable from the breaking power of nature, soundscape, and landscape, joined in the conjuring of the dead. In paradise may angels lead you. On your arrival, the martyrs receive you and lead you into the holy city, Jerusalem. An ecstasy overtook Georgie as she entered the film star's Malibu home, bought on a $10 million whim, a glass box of dreams. She made $20,000 per episode in Oksana, an income secured after years of professional struggle and compromise. Yet when she had tried to buy a Laurel Canyon ranch house and gone to Chase for a mortgage, the loan officer rejected her, citing the famously short lifespans of secondary characters on basic cable thrillers. She'd sat in her leased Prius, humiliated, ashamed, and enraged. Now she wondered at the blitheness with which money chooses some over others. Georgie had read of Carey's breakup in the tabloids. Had even watched Renee Zellweger receiving a bull's ear from Morante on the website of Pamplona's Diario de Navarra. She asked if he and Zellweger were truly finished, and he hemorrhaged. The Navajo elders joined our spirits, Renee and me. And after the breakup, I felt like my spirit had been torn apart. I felt this wound I feared would never heal. But lately, Georgie, I felt that wound closing. Lately, I've felt whole. You have? Yes. And guess what? What? Guru Viswanathan taught me to see all the colors of my aura. Oh? Yeah. And after Renee, it was bleeding out all its bright colors, just becoming this mucky gray. At night, I'd feel an evil spirit in the house.